Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we find out the winner of the ultimate Arizona history bracket.
And the complex racial and masculine identities of black college football stars.
But first, we are being bombarded with images of masked ICE agents packed at detention centers and immigrants in handcuffs as the numbers of deportations under the Trump administration is racking up. But at the same time, the number of undocumented immigrants with criminal records who are being deported is going down. And we're starting to see complaints that the mass deportation campaign is interfering with prosecutors' attempts to hold them accountable to the law. Angela Banks is an immigration law expert and vice dean of ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. She came into our studios recently to explain how this system all works, beginning with the fact that these are two separate legal systems.
First of all, generally immigration violations are treated in the immigration system, and those are civil law violations. It's not a criminal conviction. And so we have this civil system where there are immigration judges, there is the Board of Immigration Appeal where appeals go, and individuals in the immigration system, for example, non-citizens who would be found to be deportable would go before an immigration judge. That immigration judge would decide whether they are in fact deportable, and if they are deportable, whether they're entitled to any form of discretionary relief. In other words, some ability to stay here in the United States.
Right. So that's an entirely separate system that is only to do with immigration and is civil.
Exactly.
Then you have criminal.
You have your traditional criminal system. And so in that context, individuals are entitled to counsel if they can't afford one. You do not get free counsel in the immigration system the way you do in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And that is in front of state or federal court judges. And there you would go before a trial judge. You would have your case adjudicated. If you are found guilty, you could appeal to the next level of a state appeals court or a federal appeals court. But they are two separate distinct systems. The criminal system is done through the judicial branch. In immigration, it's actually under the executive branch because it's through the Department of Justice.
Right. So much of what we hear right now about immigration and deportations has to do with deporting, you know, the worst of the worst criminals, right?
Right.
How do those two systems interact in cases like that?
So what's interesting is that traditionally there has been a policy, and there's even some law in the Immigration Nationality Act, that if you are a non-citizen who's been convicted of a crime, that you would serve that criminal sentence, and then if that crime also made you deportable, after you finish serving that sentence, you would then face deportation and then be removed.
Okay. So we have seen some examples coming up in local news and nationally of kind of unintended consequences here of this mass deportation campaign. We are seeing some cases in which witnesses in a criminal proceeding have been deported before they can testify. Mm-hmm. And even in one case, the Arizona Mirror reported locally that a suspect of murder who was going to go on trial for murder was deported before any of that prosecution could happen. Do we have any sense of how often that kind of thing is going on?
Well, so there have been increased reports of this happening throughout the country, and it just highlights a tension between administration priorities. By prioritizing deporting as many people as possible and creating these quotas each month, it really is coming into tension with ideas that non-citizens who commit crimes in the United States ought to pay their debt to American society by going through the trial, if found guilty, serving their sentence in the United States. And so we're seeing those two goals sort of running up against each other.
It is raising concerns about due process.
Well, so there's definitely concerns about due process for non-citizens facing deportation right now because there's an increased use of expedited removal, which means that individuals are being deported without going before an immigration judge and having a judge decide whether or not they are in fact deportable.
Right.
And then it also just raises concerns that local communities aren't going to receive the traditional understanding of justice that they would imagine from crimes that are committed by non-citizens.
Angela, is this illegal, unconstitutional, or just against the norm?
just at this point, I would say against the norm. There is federal law that says the attorney general may not deport someone, a non-citizen, until they have completed their sentence. But as you see a number of these cases, it's before the non-citizen has been found guilty of a crime. Mm-hmm. And so they are not running afoul of that provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act.
Are we seeing prosecutors around the country challenging this and saying, like, listen, we want to put this person on trial. Don't send them away yet?
Yes, we are. And so prosecutors are, you know, many times often there used to be a way in which the prosecutors would work with the immigration enforcement officers, and there would be some cooperation to allow the individual to appear in their criminal proceedings and whatnot. We're seeing some of that break down, and I think part of that is because of the quotas and guidance that the immigration officers have been receiving about the need to reach certain numbers of people to be deported. But we are seeing prosecutors push back on that and file some legal complaints.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that expedited removal process that you mentioned, which is being used increasingly, although I don't think we know how much. Mm-hmm. The Arizona Republic is reporting right now that we are seeing immigration-related criminal prosecutions just plummet right now. What does that signal to you?
It signals to me that the administration is not using traditional tools, legal tools, to remove individuals or to respond to the criminal aspects of immigration law, but just utilizing these things like the Alien Enemies Act to remove individuals. They are increasing the use of expedited removal to remove individuals. And so there is less need because those processes don't involve going before a judge to have them determine whether or not the individual is in fact removable. It's an easier and faster process than charging them with an immigration crime, having that crime adjudicated, and then having the individual get a conviction and then be removed.
Yeah. So you are an expert on immigration law. This is kind of your bread and butter. Have you been watching these changes with a sense of surprise? Does any of this seem unprecedented to you?
It does seem unprecedented, even from the first Trump administration, where immigration was a top issue for that administration. The tools that are being utilized during this administration are really unprecedented, and we're seeing a lot more legal pushback to the strategies that are being used today.
How much might it change the work that you do and people who work in immigration law?
So it's really one of the things that's interesting is that it is challenging the work that immigration lawyers do because individuals are just being picked up, put in proceedings. Sometimes lawyers aren't able to see their clients. Mm. Sometimes lawyers aren't able to find out that their client has been picked up and is being processed for deportation. And things are moving so much more quickly that it is difficult for non-citizens to receive the representation that they would have received in the past.
Do you have broader concerns about what this means for immigration law and for due process going forward, for justice in our country?
So I have concerns not just what it means for due process and justice in immigration law, but what it means for justice and due process in American law, because I think often what happens to immigrants are the canaries in the coal mine, and that procedures and tactics that are used against immigrants first could be expanded to be used against citizens in the future. Because as the public gets used to seeing individuals just being removed without process, then the categories of people who those strategies can be used for, it can expand.
Have we seen that happen in the past?
We have seen that happen historically.
All right, we'll leave it there. Angela Banks, Vice Dean, and Charles J. Miriam, Distinguished Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU, an expert in immigration law, joining us. Angela, thank you for coming back on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's a new era for the Phoenix Police Department, as Matt Giordano took over as chief yesterday. Giordano's tenure begins with the department in transition, following a DOJ investigation which found, among other things, that officers routinely used excessive force and discriminated against the city's Black and Latino population. Given the department's troubled reputation, I found myself curious about what life as a cop is like for officers of color. And so, for one answer to that question, I sat down recently for a deep dive with Officer Dewan Brown, who's been in law enforcement for over a decade. I wanted to know what made him decide to become a cop and what he makes of how the Phoenix PD is perceived. Our conversation was, of course, just one person's perspective. He was speaking for himself, not the entire police department. But I found his origin story fascinating. It actually starts with a coincidence that has nothing to do with policing, When he was in college, a cast and crew from MTV visited his campus, and on a whim, DeJuan and a friend went to the auditions.
My friend got casted, I got casted, so we were on the show to be boyfriend, girlfriend, and then they aired the show. Very thankful to get that opportunity. So,
were you studying acting at the time?
No, I was actually going to school for criminal justice. I wanted to be a lawyer.
So then from there, you kind of got bit by the bug, or?
I did. I tried my best to live in L.A. and to do the acting, I guess, the lifestyle. When you park your car, you get about 3 tickets, you go to an audition, you get out, your car gets towed.
Right.
You got to pay your bills. And it was a fun ride. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to be a little bit more altruistic, and that's why I chose the path of policing.
You mentioned wanting to be a little bit more altruistic. Say a little bit more about that. What do you mean by that?
So when I was in college, one of my best friends ended up passing away due to a drunk driving related incident. So in between me choosing acting and kind of doing my undergrad, I kind of found a place where I said, hey, I want to do a little bit more and I want to put boots on the ground and I want to help people in a better way. And that's why I chose policing.
Mm-hmm.
I drove out here with probably like $500 to my name. And then I just went to the academy, and it was a live-in academy.
Uh-huh.
So my living expenses were pretty much taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through the Department of Corrections out in Arizona. I went to their academy and I became a correctional officer.
Was the idea of being an officer something you had ever thought about consciously when you were growing up?
No. My eye on the prize was more so to become a lawyer.
Right.
I enjoyed case law. I enjoyed reading it, interpreting case law. But sometimes it can be subjective, just like all things in life, right? But I felt like I could make more of a change with boots on the ground, talking to people,
right,
communicating every day, being in crisis situations, having the ability to help people right then and there, right now. I'd like to kind of be more preventative.
Right. When you're a lawyer, everything's already happened.
Yeah.
And you're trying to kind of reconstruct how things probably went.
Right. Right.
Can I ask, what was it about that experience of your friend who passed away that nudged you in this direction specifically? Was it something about, like, well, the person who was driving while intoxicated should be caught, or like there should be some justice for what happened?
It wasn't necessarily there should be justice for what happens. The main focus was I knew that my friend passed away.
Yeah.
And really the nail on the coffin for me, or I don't want to say that, the nail that the hammer that hit the nail in the head for me was seeing his mother when we were at the funeral and to see how distraught she was. And I told myself, I don't want to see another person like that if I can prevent that. Against whatever anybody says, like, I'm now determined to get into this field, come hell or high water.
So you get to Arizona, and you start out as a corrections officer.
Yes.
What were those early experiences like, and how did it speak to that intention that you had?
So that intention that I had was quieted a little bit when I got into the Department of Corrections.
Uh-huh.
Because in the Department of Corrections, you're working with people who have already been convicted of crimes. Most likely, if you're in a prison setting, they're going to be felons. I had to compartmentalize and understand that although they've committed crimes and they're felons, they're still people as well, and I need to treat them the same way as I would treat any other person. So even though I'm not out there, obviously at this point in my career, stopping crime and preventing things from happening, I'm still here providing the best service that I can provide to people, which is treating them like human beings, giving them things that they deserve, being respectful. My first couple of months, I experienced, I viewed a lot of violent activity. It's a very violent place. A lot of people call it the concrete jungle. But I also viewed a lot of people who were reformed, a lot of people who wanted change, a lot of people who they believed in a higher being, a lot of people who, you know, they were repenting for the things that they did. So it was very surreal to see grown men, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s tell you, hey, you know, I made these choices. Don't make these same choices. You can change your life. You can do better than I can. And they barely knew me. So it kind of gave me a very personal perspective on how to talk to people when you meet people on their worst day. And you say, hey, yeah, you did this crime or you committed this act, but you're still a human being.
Yeah. Did The violence that you witnessed in that setting, did that ever make you question the decision?
No. It made me empathize with the situation, and it made me understand further that this is the field that I'm in, that in some instances, when you're in a setting, there will be violence, and violence is not pretty. And in some instances, when this happens, my job was to react and to stop the violence. I'm getting this education in the field of like gangs, learning sign language, learning the lingo, learning how they communicate, learning, you know, who talks to who, etc. And I can take that and use that. I could utilize that on the street.
So when do you move from, or how do you move from corrections work to the work you're doing now?
So I applied to work for another agency.
And when you say agency, that's like a police force.
Yeah, sorry.
In the Valley.
Yeah, police force in the Valley.
Okay.
The colloquial term is agency. That's,
okay.
That's what we
okay.
kind of use.
Yeah. And what did you like about that as distinct from the CO work you were doing?
Being a police officer, you're kind of like in control of your day, meaning you have a plethora of different calls that you go to. They all require different levels of intensity, intelligence, and everyone is in their own crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an opportunity to change everybody's day. A lot of people that I encountered, they just made bad decisions,
mm-hmm.
heat-of-the-moment decisions. Some of them were premeditated, but when you got an opportunity to sit and speak with them in a calm setting and just you ask them, hey, what's your name? You know, where were you born? And you kind of humanize the badge. A lot of people opened up to you. They would listen. They would tell you, hey, this is what's going on in my life. I'm dealing with the passing of my mother, which caused me to lash out at, you know, my husband. And I shouldn't be here, but this was my fault.
So can I ask you, I mean, from the way you're talking about it, you're talking about having a lot of empathy for the people that you're interacting with. I'm sure you know that there are a lot of negative perceptions of police officers, particularly in Phoenix. In the wake of the DOJ investigation, for people who do have a negative perception, where do you think that gap comes from? The perception that police officers are going to be aggressive towards certain populations or not empathetic in the way that you are describing being empathetic.
I think people become upset because there's been different pockets of different types of interactions with different types of police officers or sheriffs. Or people that just are, you know, work for law enforcement. Law enforcement is not parallel. They don't all work in unison. And I think people identify the uniform universally as one. And I understand people have that perception of policing, but I think with more transparency, people will start to maybe understand a little bit more what police officers deal with. I think that if people were to take away a little bit of their bias, kind of open up their mindset a little bit and inquire against their bias, they might see that what their perception is necessarily not the reality.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, college football promises players prestige, exposure, and opportunity. But what are the pitfalls? We'll hear about the intersection of race, masculinity, and motherhood on the gridiron.
But first, we continue with my conversation with Phoenix Police Officer Duan Brown. Before the break, Officer Brown mentioned that he thinks a lot of people don't realize, quote, what police officers deal with. I asked him what he meant by that.
You know, I've been standing with a couple other officers, and I've heard a couple of expletives involving, like, my color. And that's... That had nothing to do with the situation. It had nothing to do with a call for service. It had nothing to do with anything. It was just the choice of words that people chose to use just to attack me because I was in uniform and I'm of a certain color.
And you weren't interacting with them at all?
No. You also have certain communities that say, hey, well, culturally you should be this, but you're putting on a uniform to do this. So
can you say more about what you mean by that?
So I can. I want to expound on it in the safest way because I don't want to offend anybody. But culturally, you should not be a police officer. You should be doing something else.
Like, as a person of a certain ethnicity?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay.
As a person of a certain ethnicity, you should not be in this field.
Okay.
And my counteraction to that is, as a person of a certain color, I should be in this field. So I could show you the different sides of policing. So I could be an example for that young adult that wants to maybe be in this field and make a difference. Or maybe they want to do this and then they want to go and be a federal judge, but they have the experience of working with people hand in hand. So, you know, I can be a conduit for them, but you have to get rid of that bias. And you can't just say because of you assume that my cultural, my cultural upbringing is this, I should act this certain way. That's not how it works.
Are these conversations you have amongst yourselves, like as officers? Like, we know that we're perceived a certain way. People aren't understanding the whole story. How do we counteract that? Like, is that something officers talk about amongst themselves?
I definitely believe that they are having these conversations. You know, from my personal experience, I can tell you people want to do better. We want people to perceive us in a positive light, and we want to be there to help. It's just unfortunate that sometimes if a certain crime is committed or someone does a certain wrong, there has to be an arrest. There has to be this. It's a part of the law. Sometimes we have to separate a person who's committed a crime so that we could prevent something worse from even happening. But sometimes people don't see that because they're just seeing what's in front of them and not the long run.
If we think back to that version of yourself that had to go to this funeral and saw your friend's mom really suffering, do you still feel a connection with that version of yourself? Is that still what, you know, like gets you out of bed every day to do the job? Or has it changed?
Oh, it's always stayed the same. I think the key to success in this job is humility. Every day is you have to have humility, because this is not a career where you can wake up and say, well, I'm the leader of all leaders and I can, that doesn't work here.
Right.
Because people see right through that, you know, and sometimes on very contentious calls for service, you know, to prevent something from, you know, blowing up, you might have to talk to somebody and you have to have humility because they might be at a level 10 and you're at a level 2 and they just want to be heard. And as long as you're taught, you're listening per se, and you're letting them de-escalate, right, deflate that hot air. And now they're at a point where they can listen. Now you can say, hey, I heard what you're saying. I understand your feelings are valid, but we need you guys to let us do our job. And that comes from humility. You have to have that in this job. That's what keeps me motivated to keep doing what I'm doing. The second I feel like I'm no longer connected to that person that started this position, I'll probably quit. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So circling back, you know, we started our conversation talking about your acting work. Are you still acting?
Yes.
Okay. What does that look like for you these days?
For example, one time I booked a gig through my agency and I had to go to Utah for 3 days. So they flew me out to Utah for 3 days, shot my lines, and then I flew back into Arizona. And then that night I had to go to work and worked my whole shift. It's definitely a little surreal to go from set being kind of pampered and you're reading lines and you have lights everywhere and you have, you know, a person in your ear trying to tell you what to do, or you have a person holding a boom mic, and then switching gears and, you know, you're standing like in an alleyway at 4 a.m. talking to somebody and trying to determine if they're a suspect to a crime.
Right. When you are working as a police officer, do you feel like you're playing a character or do you feel like you're being yourself?
That's a good question. I probably say I feel like I'm being myself. Now, some people, when they find out that I work with that, hey, you're in movies or you've been in the movie or commercials, they look at me differently. Like, I don't see you as I've never seen you in this light. But then they look up some things and like, oh, well, I guess I was wrong. You can do both.
Well, Officer DeJuan Brown, thank you for this conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Nearly 2 million of the Valley's roughly 5 million residents live in the West Valley, and a new report says the area's population is expected to grow at twice the national rate over the next 5 years. Why West Valley? A report compiled by the commercial real estate firm CBRE also finds nearly half of the area's residents are younger than 35.
But it's not just population growth that West Valley leaders are excited about. There's been business and job expansion there as well. Cintra Hoffman is president and CEO of the group Westmark, which helped put the report together. She spoke with our co-host Mark Brody, who asked why what about it stands out to her.
The main purpose of the Why West Valley report started a few years ago, and it really is intended to be kind of a broker's digest of information or resource of information on the West Valley. So I think the main takeaway is, as you all know, I think as everyone knows, the West Valley has drastically changed over the last 5 years. So it's really drastically updated information as to what's happening today. And I think some of the main things that you'll see in this year's report is a lot more tech companies that are in there, and kind of a higher growth rate of tech startups, 30% to be exact.
Do you get the sense that that story is known beyond the West Valley?
I think that TSMC has really put Arizona and with the Phoenix metro region on the map. What I think a lot of people don't really realize is that TSMC is west of I-17. It really technically is in the West Valley. So a lot of the companies that you're seeing coming in, Amcor and others in the supply chain that are yet to be announced, are in the West Valley. And I think that's the piece that's kind of missing. People clearly know that there's a lot of activity happening and it's a new West Valley, but they don't really necessarily associate it with the technology explosion that's really happening here right now. And I think this report will definitely help share some of the hard data behind that.
How much of what you're seeing in that part of the valley do you attribute to TSMC?
I would say over the last 10 years, we have started seeing an investment in companies such as Amazon and Microsoft and some of the bigger names in the tech space coming into the West Valley. And so we've started seeing that gradual immersion of tech companies. They're more, you know, we've seen some data centers, obviously with Microsoft investments and education programs to support that workforce development in those areas. So it's been happening over the last 10 years or so. However, TSMC, it being just a global name and the largest global investment today, now we're all of a sudden all eyes are on the West Valley. But it's not necessarily brand new. That magnitude is definitely brand new to not only the state, but really globally.
So I know that in the past, you and I have talked about concerns that you and other economic development folks in the West Valley had about the number of people who live there who had to travel to go to work, either to Phoenix or the East Valley or somewhere like that. I wonder now that, you know, companies, as you say, are really starting to expand and grow in the West Valley, how significant is that both to the economy, but also for the folks who live there to allow them to stay there during the day?
It's huge. You know, post-pandemic, people obviously really don't want to drive and making decisions to work locally. The White West Valley Report has a great listing of major household name companies. Amazon employs almost 18,000 employees in this region that's located in the West Valley. Obviously, the Air Force at almost 10,000 and so on. So you have some significant employers that exist in the West Valley today that are employing thousands of people. So as these now, the tech companies that are growing, such as Amcor, Outer Space, GTI Fabrication, and so on, they're also in the mid to high hundreds, and they're going to be growing. So the jobs are definitely growing in our backyard. And I think that's great for people. It's great for the quality of life and what people have been looking for. They don't want to make the commute. Nobody wants to sit on the roads. So I think, you know, finding jobs more locally is definitely what our residents want and what companies are responding to.
So you mentioned tech companies. Obviously, logistics has always been a big focus for economic development in the West Valley, especially once Loop 303 connected to I-10. Are those sort of the main sectors that you are seeing grow and expand in the West Valley? Are there others, other types of companies or other types of jobs that are coming there as well?
So, yes, while we have a growing number of tech jobs and have had in logistics for a while, our leading industry is actually healthcare, which makes sense because healthcare is driven by population. And with 1.9 million residents living west of I-17, almost 2 million, when you look at a greater region of 5.1 million residents, right? Maricopa County, this greater region is 5.1 million. And then you have almost 2 million west of I-17. You're going to definitely need a lot of healthcare providers. And we're seeing that hospitals are stepping up to that and making those investments. More importantly, we're seeing that specialized care. Phoenix Children's, they have invested in Arrowhead, so in the Northwest Valley, in Avondale in the Southwest Valley, and they're looking at other areas as they're seeing that younger population grow. So I think that's a big industry that really, you know, we have the basis for it because we have the population for it.
You have been talking about the potential of the West Valley for quite a while now. I wonder if what you are seeing now and some of what this report points out, is this that potential?
Absolutely. It's funny that you say that because I reflect on exactly what you said is, oh my goodness, we've been saying it's coming, it's coming. It's not coming. It's here. It's been here. And I think, you know, now all of a sudden we're realizing, wait, we need to change that statement. You know, we need to change that narrative. It's not coming to us. It's already here. I think the issue that we have now is making sure that we get the correct message out that, in fact, these businesses are here. These people are here. These companies are here. The quality of life is here. When we look at the investments that are being made, such as the Vi Resort, the concerts that are coming to State Farm Stadium, to Desert Diamond Arena, to Phoenix Raceway and all that, we definitely have that global entertainment that's coming to the area. So the West Valley is on the map by far.
Cintra Hoffman is president and CEO of Westmark. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Well, who is the most influential person in Arizona history? Is it groundbreaking architect Frank Lloyd Wright or Del Webb, founder of Sun City, or someone more on the artistic side like hard rocker Alice Cooper or Tucson daughter Linda Ronstadt? Well, our next guest created the ultimate bracket to find out. Jeremy Duda is a native Arizonan, a self-proclaimed history nerd and reporter for Axios Phoenix, and he joins us now to reveal the big winner. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning.
Okay, so you had quite a list of notable Arizonans here, but it all came down to two really big ones. Of course, longtime Arizona Senator John McCain made the final two, and so did Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. So tell us, who took home the title?
That was Sandra Day O'Connor, and it was not close. She got about 65% of the vote. I was kind of surprised. I started out from the beginning thinking that John McCain would probably win just for being the more recent figure and still, you know, very beloved by a lot of folks here in Arizona, but it was O'Connor.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that, too. I would have thought John McCain right off the bat. Okay, but tell us more about Sandra Day O'Connor. Obviously, the first woman on the Supreme Court, everyone knows that, but she also had a long and very influential history here in Arizona.
Sure. Yeah. Before she was on the Supreme Court, she was very involved in the political and civic life here in Arizona. She was on the state personnel board in the late 60s. She resigned that for an appointment to the state Senate, became Senate Majority Leader, I believe was the first woman to have a leadership position in the legislative chamber here in Arizona. Was pretty influential as a legislator, had some important legislation on mental health that her son tells me was inspired by her time working out at the state hospital for the Attorney General's office. Mm-hmm. She had went kind of line by line, statute by statute through the Arizona Revised Statutes to repealing the laws that had the discriminatory language against women. Then after, you know, I think about 5 years or so in the legislature, she ran for a spot on Maricopa County Superior Court, was elected a judge. I believe she was part of the last class of elected judges in Arizona or in Maricopa County before she voters passed the merit selection system, which she had a big role in as well, and then the Court of Appeals, and of course, the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow. Okay. Quite a history. Okay. So there's our winner. But I think my favorite thing about this, Jeremy, and I know this is something you've been wanting to do for a long time, so I'm sure you enjoyed this, was this long list you put together of names of great Arizonans. People, lots of us maybe have heard the name of, but didn't actually know who they were. So let's talk about a few of those. I was interested in Jack Swilling. Tell us about him.
Jack Swilling is kind of a wild character. He was, I believe, a Confederate veteran who, after the Civil War, ended up traveling through Arizona, and when he and his party were here, he noticed agricultural potential of the soil here, and he began kind of excavating some of the old Hohokam canals and built the first kind of modern irrigation system, and I believe that's the basis, formed kind of the basis of the irrigation system we still have today in the valley.
What about
kind
Francis?
Of the modern founder of Phoenix.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, tell us about Francis Willard Munns. I've heard of Munns Park. I did not know it was named after someone. Tell us about that.
Yeah, she's kind of unfortunately kind of an unsung figure, although less unsung than she used to be. There's now a statue of her at Bolin Plaza over by the Capitol, and she was a early suffrage leader and was a big part of the push to put women's suffrage on the ballot in 1912, the year we got statehood, and she went on to get elected to the legislature, I believe the Senate, for a number of years after that.
Okay, so that goes pretty far back in Arizona history, but you've got people also like Jerry Colangelo on this list, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, and Colangelo obviously is still around today, still out here, and his influence on the valley, it's hard to overstate it. I mean, nothing says big city like having, you know, major professional sports teams. And, you know, as Phoenix was growing up, he was the one who brought the first professional sports team here to the valley with the Phoenix Suns in the late 60s. And for many years, that was, for 20 years, that was all we had. That was our claim to fame sports-wise until, you know, the Cardinals moved here in the 80s. And then, of course, the Coyotes, and then Colangelo brought the Diamondbacks here as well in the late 90s.
Yeah, my goodness. Wow. Okay, we can't do the segment without talking about Wallace and Ladmo, everybody's favorite sort of duo from back in the day. Tell us about them.
Oh, I mean, anyone who grew up in Phoenix, you know, up through the 1980s, you know, Wallace and Ladmo was just a part of growing up, was a part of your life. You know, hear the words Ladmo bag, and it brings back a lot of memories about either how much you wish you had gotten one or how happy you were. And speaking as probably the last generation of Arizonans who grew up watching Wallace and Ladmo, I think it went off in the air in 1989, you know, it still brings back a lot of memories for me and just such a integral part of, you know, childhood and growing up if you're from here in the valley. And of course, this is, you know, a state of transplants. Lots of folks aren't from here, but that I think is sort of a point of pride for those of us who did grow up here, that we grew up watching that incredible show.
Yeah. Okay, last question for you, Jeremy, in the last minute or so here. You said you would not have chosen Sandra Day O'Connor as the most influential Arizonan, and you picked someone else that probably not many other people did. Who did you pick?
I would have picked Carl Hayden, who, you know, he was in the Senate for 42 years. And you have to remember at that time, seniority counted for everything over there. Arizona was a very small state, would not normally have gotten a lot out of the federal government, but because Carl Hayden's, you know, decades of seniority, he directed a lot of, you know, of federal funding and whatnot to the state, ending his career, capping it off with the passage of the Central Arizona Project, you know, that brought, you know, the irrigation project that brought water from the Colorado River to the interior of the state, which is still of paramount importance and led to a lot of explosive growth, which we're still seeing the benefits of today.
That's really interesting. So you walk by those canals, you can thank Carl Hayden. All right. Sure. We will leave it there for now. That is Jeremy Duda, native Arizonan, our history nerd here, joining us to talk about his bracket for Axios Phoenix on the most influential Arizonans. Jeremy, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. When Tracy Canada was an undergrad at Duke University, she found herself living in a dorm with a bunch of members of the school's football team. And the more she talked to them, she found herself fascinated by their unique status on campus. In a way, they were kind of TV stars, appearing regularly in nationally televised games. They were often given free gear from prestigious brands like Nike, and they walked around campus in brightly colored uniforms with the school's name on their chests. They were celebrities. But Canada couldn't help noticing that they were also, in many cases, black men, and that meant that in spite of their prestige, they were also subject to the same challenges and pressures that other black students faced. In some ways, she thought they were even more vulnerable. These experiences inspired the research Canada went on to do for her PhD, much of which she chronicles in her book, Tackling the Everyday. The book explores the delicate role that black college football players are asked to play, and with the season just weeks away, I spoke with Canada recently about her work. She told me that when she started writing this book, the NFL was in the midst of the controversies surrounding Colin Kaepernick's on-field protests and players at the University of Missouri threatening to go on strike. She figured it would be easy to get players to talk about race, but it wasn't that simple.
And one of the first things that somebody told me, somebody on the team, one of the teams that I was working with, told me that race didn't matter there. That's not something that they took into account. And this was a player that was active on the roster, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was so fascinated by this statement. I was like, I'm going to hold on to that because there's something in the way that you are analyzing your own experience that to you, it's not a thing.
Yeah.
But when I would go to practices and I would see a coach telling players to just go to the sidelines, they were going to work on something, right? And almost evenly split, all of the white players went to one side and all of the black players went to another.
Wow.
I was like, this is a fascinating display.
Wow.
Of, like, you not thinking that race matters, which is fair, right? Like, if that's the way that you're analyzing this experience. But to me, it was fascinating the way that they just so immediately split.
Yeah.
So those were the types of scenarios and situations where I was like, okay, there's something here.
Absolutely.
Which is how this ended up being a book about relationships, about the way that people interact with each other.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that you are highlighting in this book is this idea of football and maybe sports more broadly being marketed to athletes as a source of family. And that there are some ways in which it mirrors those structures, and that there are some ways in which that is a bit of a false promise, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think football is uniquely positioned in this because the idea of the football family is something that is constantly repeated. It's a helpful analytic for administrators, for institutions to call it a family, because that's a way to get all of those people on board, right? To say that, like, you're all working together, you all want what's best for the person beside you. And really what that means is that we all want to win, right? That does not necessarily mean that there's a vested interest in the individual well-being of all of the people who make up that family.
Right.
And we have to keep in mind that the majority of the people who make up this quote-unquote football family are football players themselves, right? And without the football players, none of this works. If they stop playing, if they are no longer invested, if they get too injured, right? Like, this goes away. This version of family is very invested in something that I call corporeal concern, which is this idea that the body has to be healthy enough and interested enough in playing football on behalf of this team and this football family.
Yeah.
Right. And if that body is no longer able to produce on behalf of the family, then it's no longer useful.
Yeah. And it so flies in the face of what, you know, I think many people would think of as a familial relationship with a physical body, which is that maybe even more when a family member's physical body becomes unwell, our level of care and attention increases. It doesn't decrease.
Right.
One of the other things that you talk about, and it feels related to this idea of care and who's caring for who, is what type of masculinity is welcome in these environments.
Yeah, that's a part of the book that I think comes from the fact that I am a Black feminist scholar. One part of that is, I think, important is also the focus on mothers. So I do have a whole chapter in the book about the players' mothers in a way that I think gives visibility to the labor that they also contribute to this entire system.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, like the twin argument that's happening in the book is to say that these are quite intimate relationships that players have with each other. There's an intimacy of football because tackling requires you to get really close to another person, right?
Yeah.
And your body is coming up against somebody else's body, right? Like, there's a particular intimacy that's involved in this sport. But then there's also the side of, like, what it means to be living in this particular body at this particular time, when there are so many violences that are often enacted against Black male bodies, right? Mm-hmm. So being aware of that experience as well means that Black players are able to see each other in a very particular way that is often not replicated with other people, right? There's a certain recognition. There's a certain type of care that then comes with that of like, I'm going to care for you. I'm going to make sure that you are okay. There's a particular assumption that we have about football players because of what is required from the sport. It's violent, it's dangerous, it's loud. And the type of person that you think needs to play that sport, you don't often also say, oh, but he like has this really sweet relationship with his mom. Someone who takes time out of his day to go visit his teammate in the hospital because he's been hurt. And his family can't fly into town yet. So he's going to go sit with him in the hospital room right. while he waits for surgery until his family comes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is such a beautiful example that you just shared because, to me, that links back to what we were talking about this familial relationship mm-hmm. with the body mm-hmm. rather than the institutional.
Yeah, I do want you to be well, and I want your body to be healthy, right? Like, I want your body to be functioning. Part of that is that so that you can play football if that's what you want to do. But also I'm trying to make sure that like when we both get out of here, when we both graduate, when we both leave this place, we are okay, right? Yeah. And whatever way that that means, that we are able to live our lives past this experience.
I want to make sure that we touch on the chapter about the mothers, which you alluded to.
Moms are integral to the entire thing. Actually, without their buy-in and without their support, college football doesn't exist. They are usually the ones that kind of stamp the approval to say that it's okay for their son to go to that college to play.
Yeah.
So coaches know that. And so they're figuring in that way, right? But then spending time with these mothers, I would hear these stories of how they were the ones that would wake their sons up in high school to go work out or practice with them
yeah.
at 6 o'clock in the morning mm-hmm. before they went to work,
right?
They're the ones who travel every week to a game, whether or not the son is playing. They travel every week to the game, right? Like they organize the family dinner that happens after the game. They get everybody together for the carpool, right? Like that's the type of work that they're doing in that way, mm-hmm. right? So they want them to be successful on the football field, but then after the game, they're asking them questions about like, okay, have you done your homework? What do we need to do here? Do you have enough food? Have you done your laundry?
Yeah.
Like, who's this friend? Who are you talking to, right? Like they're asking them questions about their life away from football because they want them to have this like general well experience that's
yeah.
like more holistic,
right?
And because these were Black mothers as well, who are themselves uniquely positioned, right, as Black women in the world, they also have an understanding in a completely different way of these experiences of anti-Blackness that their sons might experience and probably have already experienced by the time that they get to college, right?
Right.
And so not only are they concerned with them being okay on the football field, not only are they concerned with their life in college, but they're also hoping that they live past college.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Tracy Canada, who is the Andrew W. Mellon Assistant Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Duke University and the author of the book we've been talking about, which is called Tackling the Everyday. Dr. Canada, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for tackling another morning of the news and culture with us here on the show. Remember, there's always more than we can get to in this hour. That's why we have our weekly newsletter, Radio Heads. Sign up at theshow.kjzz.org.
It is a good read, a little behind the scenes, and that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks so much. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.